apprentice, and carried them absently, his eyes sweeping everywhere, even here in Habble Morning.
"I'm not frightened," Bridget replied. "I'm simply considering the possibilities."
"Such as falling off the spire?"
Raoul asked. Bridget followed.
"Yes."
"Or some enormous monster flying in from the mist and devouring you?"
"I'm certain the tower's defences are perfectly adequate to repel mist moors."
"Or being driven mad by the light of the sun?"
Bridget's fingers immediately went to her neck, where her goggles with their protective lenses hung.
"Raoul, my friend, you are at times a perfect little monster."
Raoul gave his tail a disdainful flick.
"I am a perfect everything."
"You speak with the cats, Miss Tarquin?"
asked the man walking beside her. Captain Grimm, his arm still in its grimy sling, looked like a man who should be collapsing from exhaustion, but his voice was steady, polite, his eyes alert.
"Imperfectly," Bridget said. "Though honestly, I think most of them understand every word we say, except when they don't, of course."
He glanced at Raoul, smiling.
"An unkind thing to say of a hero."
Raoul flicked his tail again, his expression unrepentantly smug. Bridget smiled at that and rubbed her nose against Raoul's furry head.
"He is a hero. And a tyrant."
The cat looked up at her and yawned. Grimm let out a short bark of laughter.
"Aye, aye. The cat who lived on Perilous was much the same. He didn't take orders well, and we were lucky to have him."
"This one,"
Raoul said, looking at Grimm.
"This one seems smarter than most humans, little mouse. I have decided that he may stay."
"Given that it is his ship that will carry us," Bridget said, her tone dry, "that seems very practical."
Grimm seemed to infer Raoul's portion of the exchange, and inclined his head slightly to the cat.
"At your service, sir." "Ah, the guard station. Good."
Their small group had reached the top of the ramp leading up to the shipyards. A large metal grate had been lowered over the doorway out, and at least 20 marines stood on guard at it. Gwendolyn Lancaster had evidently taken her duty seriously. She was already there, speaking quietly with a senior sergeant, showing him the letter of authorization from the Spyrarch. The marine did not look pleased with her. Gwen frowned, put one fist on her hip, and said something to the man with a rather tart expression on her face. The marine's weather-beaten face grew redder, but he growled and jerked a hand in a quick motion. One of his men went to the grate and began pulling on a rope that lifted it, opening the way to the shipyards. Light, nearly as bright as the flash of a discharged gauntlet, poured down the ramp from the outside world. With it came a breath of wind and air that was much colder than that of the Habble in which Bridget had grown up. There was a strange scent to it, wood, and burnt wood, and metal, and something else, something sharp and fresh. Bridget's heart started pounding. Captain Grimm said something to her, but she wasn't sure what. They walked up the ramp and into the sharp-scented air and the dazzling light. It was bright, painfully bright, like suddenly understanding a truth she would prefer to be anything else. She had to blink her eyes closed as the cold air hit her in the face, an utter shock of sensation. She had never felt anything like it. Then she remembered in a panic how dangerous it was to let the light touch her unprotected eyes, and she fumbled blindly at the goggles around her neck. It was difficult, with only one hand to use, but she finally managed to lift them to her face and hold them there with her quivering fingers. The dark lenses reduced the glare of the light, and she could suddenly see. For a moment she wished she couldn't. There were structures and airships and people everywhere in the shipyard. But that was of distant secondary importance. She looked up and felt as though she might simply fall over onto the ground out of sheer disorientation. There was no ceiling. There was no ceiling. She looked up, and up,
and up, and up. And there was simply nothing overhead. Nothing but a light, fine veil of mist that rose into infinite distance above her. She felt an irrational conviction that she was balanced on a precipice, and that a single misstep might betray her and send her body flying up into the void. She jerked her eyes back down to the floor. She fought away a sudden, overwhelming impulse to throw herself prone and hang on to the solid spire-stone floor for dear life.
"Easy," she heard Captain Grimm saying. "For some, the first time is a shock, Miss Targwyn."
"I'm sorry," she managed to say. "I don't mean to make a scene. Normally I am quite composed."
"You're doing better than I did," Grimm said. "I lost my breakfast, and couldn't make myself look up again for days."
"What did you do?"
"I kept trying until I looked up," he said. "It got better. Don't be hard on yourself, miss. It will pass."
"I think it's very interesting,"
Raoul said in a calm, pleased tone. Bridget choked off something that might have come out a laugh or a sob. She wasn't sure which. She still felt dizzy, sickened, but clearly this problem wasn't going to solve itself. The sky wasn't going anywhere. So she took a deep breath and forced herself to lift her eyes again. She could see a burning orb outlined in the mist. The sun. She had never seen it like this, without it being filtered and diffused through the translucent sections of spire stone around the Habel. It burned, like no candle or crystal she had ever seen.
"That's," she breathed, "that's lovely."
Grimm glanced up and then smiled.
"A bit of a dingy view," he said. "When time serves, you should see what the sky really looks like."
"You mean?"
Bridget asked, pointing.
"Up there?"
She turned to find Captain Grimm staring up and smiling serenely.
"Up there. Up in the deep blue sky. If you think the sun is beautiful, wait until you see it without all the mist. And the moon. And the stars. There is no beauty like that of the stars on a clear night, Miss Targwyn."
"But," she said, "isn't it dangerous to see such things? I thought men who did went mad."
"Oh, you'll need goggles during the day, it's true," Grimm replied. "Airships sail in etheric currents, and they interact oddly with sunlight. If one doesn't protect one's eyes from them, it can do strange things to one's mind."
Bridget glanced ahead of them at Master Ferris.
Is that why Lord Albion's man is so odd?"
"He's an etherealist, Miss Targwyn," Grimm replied. "For most of us, etheric currents flow around us like a stream of water flowing around stones. But for some folk, etheric energy doesn't go around. It courses right through them. They draw it to them."
He shook his head.
"Goggles are sufficient for the likes of you and me, miss. But there's no protection for a man like Master Ferris."
"He's mad?"
Bridget asked in a quiet voice.
"So is his apprentice, though less so," Grimm said. "Master Ferris is the fourth etherealist I've met in my lifetime. They've all been mad. The only question is whether or not it shows."
"Oh,"
Bridget said.
"I do not mean to pester you with more questions, Captain, if you have duties to see to."
He shook his head. "By all means, miss, ask. I am to provide you with my support, after all. Presumably sharing what modest knowledge I have falls into the purview of that duty. Ask your questions."
"Thank you. The etherealists, can they really do what the stories say?"
asked Bridget.
"It depends on which stories you've heard, I suppose," Grimm said.
"The usual, I think,"
Bridget said. "Burnham's Tales. The stories of Finch and Broom." Grimm smiled a bit and spread his hands.
"Well, they are perhaps a touch overblown."
"But etherealists really can do such things. Bridget asked. Call lightning with a word of power. Make a mystic gesture and fly.
Try not to think of it that way,
Grimm said. Etherealists are, in many ways, simply etheric engineers.
Etheric engineers cannot call lightning, sir, or fly.
No? Grimm asked.
But they can design etheric weaponry, such as gauntlets, long guns, and cannon, can they not? Can they not design an airship and send it aloft into the sky?
True, Bridget said. But those are... they're weapons and ships. Of course they do that. They design and build devices to a function. It's what they do.
My point is that an etherealist does the same sorts of things, miss. It's just that he skips the troublesome part in the middle.
Bridget found herself smiling. Oh, she said. Is that all he does?
Grimm winked at her.
Are they dangerous? She asked.
He was silent for a moment before he said thoughtfully, Anyone can be dangerous, Mr. Ogwin, etherealist or not. He smiled at her, but then his face sobered. But between the two of us, I think they are capable of more than we know. For myself, I think it wise to keep a very open mind.
They had walked down the length of the shipyard as they spoke, and had come to a large boarding ramp that led up to an airship. Captain Grimm, Bridget asked, is this your vessel?
Aye, Grimm replied, unmistakable pride in his voice. This is Predator, Miss Targwin. I take it you have not been aboard an airship before.
Bridget shook her head, staring up. I've never even seen one.
Predator was, Bridget thought, rather impressive. The main body of the ship seemed to be a large and oddly contoured half-tube, suspended between three rounded towers that rose up at either end of the ship and in her very middle. Folded along her flanks were a number of bundled rods of some kind that looked like they could be folded out, and old-style canvas cloth hung from them. Sails, she realized, made to be extended horizontally along the ship's flanks. Other masts had been folded against her belly, which was held clear of the stone of the shipyard by heavy struts that supported the vessel's weight. And she saw two more masts on the ship's main deck rose up above the ship, their yardarms spread, with more sails reefed against them. Running up the length of both masts were large metal rings that encircled twisted lengths of ether silk sail, the ship's ether web. Most airships she had read about had steam engines in place as their secondary propulsion system. The only ships that favoured sails were those operated by the fleets of very poor spires, or by scoundrels such as pirates, smugglers and the like, who were willing to dare the dangers of the mists rather than sail in open skies. Positioned all around the vessel, at the bases of the masts, she could see large reels lined with the net-like woven ether silk webs that harnessed the etheric currents that would drive airships faster than any other transport in the world. She understood the principle simply enough. The more webbing one let out of the reel, the more etheric energy it could catch, and the faster it would drive the ship forward. Of course, the web had to be charged with electricity in order for it to function, so airships were limited in the amount of web they could charge by the strength of their power cores. And there were the weapons. The gun emplacements protruded bulbously from the ship's deck, the copper-barreled cannon snouts nosing out from a costly rotating ball assembly that would allow the gun crews to swing the cannon forward and aft as well as up and down. She had no way to judge how large the weapons were in comparison to others of the breed, but they certainly looked formidable. One of the gun emplacements, Bridget noted, was simply missing. There were a number of freshly cut boards around it, suggesting that it had been damaged in some fashion, necessitating the removal of more wood in order to provide a stable platform to replace the missing assembly. And the entire ship, she realized, was made of wood. So much wood that it beggared her imagination.
She remembered how proud her father had been when they had been able to afford the polished wooden service counter at the Vattery, and how careful he was to clean and maintain it. It had cost a week's profit for enough wood to build a counter 10 feet long and 3 feet wide. And Predator, Bridget realized, was a dozen times that length, and as high as a two-story house. All of it wood. There were men on the ship, moving all over it, men carrying crates and bags up the boarding ramp, men on lines hanging down the side of the ship, applying oil to her hull, men atop the towers, men climbing the masts and working with the reefed sails, men scrubbing down the deck, men inspecting the weapon emplacements, men coiling costly ether silk webbing more neatly onto its reel. There was a small army aboard this vessel, Bridget realized, each of them performing some kind of specific task, and it was a good thing there were so many of them. They might not have survived the confrontation in the tunnel without the aeronauts, whatever Gwendolyn seemed to think.
"If you will excuse me, Miss Targwyn," Captain Grimm said, "there are many things to which I must attend before we can leave."
Bridget inclined her head. "Of course, sir." He nodded and bowed slightly at the waist.
"Someone will be down momentarily to show your party where to go."
He ascended the ramp, weaving between several men carrying various burdens without missing a step. Raoul was staring up at the ship, his eyes intent, tracking motion, his ears pulled to quivering attention, straight forward.
"Little Mouse," he said, "that looks interesting."
"Not too interesting, I trust," Bridget said. "Airships are quite dangerous, you know."
"Dangerous,"
Raoul said, contempt dripping from the word.
"For humans, perhaps."
"Don't be foolish," she said. "There could be any number of hazards in there. Machinery, electrical wiring, weaponry. If you go exploring, you might find something that could hurt you."
"If one doesn't, one is not truly exploring,"
Raoul replied.
"But since you worry so badly, and since I know you will not stop speaking of it, regardless of how foolish you sound, I will remain near you, to make sure that you do not run afoul of hazards aboard the ship, of course."
"Thank you," Bridget said.
"But those tall ship trees standing up on top?"
"We call them masts," Bridget said. She had to use the human word for them. The tongue of the cat had the occasional shortcoming.
"Ship trees,"
Raoul said in an insistent tone.
"Those interest me. I will climb them."
"All the way up there?" Bridget asked. She felt slightly dizzy just thinking of the view from the mast tops. "It seems unnecessary."
Raoul turned his head and gave her a level look. Then he said,
"I sometimes forget that you are just a human."
He flicked his ears dismissively and looked back up at the masts.
"A cat would understand."
"Just so long as the cat doesn't fall," she said.
Raoul made a growling sound, an expression of displeasure that needed no special skill to understand. Bridget smiled. She couldn't help it. The little monster was so full of himself that she couldn't help but tease him from time to time. She hugged Raoul gently and rubbed her nose against the fur on his head. Raoul growled again, but with much less sincerity. Suddenly there was a presence beside her, and Bridget looked up to see that the etherealist's apprentice was standing next to her. The girl with the oddly coloured eyes stared up at the ship, but not, Bridget noted, at the features to which her own eyes had been drawn. Instead, the girl seemed to stare intently at the featureless planks of Predator's flanks, and left Bridget with the slightly unsettling impression that the girl's mismatched eyes were peering straight through the wood.
"Oh, my!"
the girl said, ducking her head enough to make it clear that she was speaking to the jar of expended looming crystals she still held cradled in one arm.
"Have you ever seen one like that?"
"Beg pardon, miss?"
Bridget said politely. Oh, they're talking to me again. The girl told the jar. Why must people always talk to me when I leave the house? Bridget blinked several times at her response. What did one do in such a situation? It seemed unthinkable that they should stand together looking at such an impressive creation and not carry on some sort of polite conversation.
I'm afraid I don't know your name, miss. We are to be working together, it seems. My name is Bridget Tarquin, and this is Raoul.
The girl smiled and said to the jar,
This is Bridget Tarquin, and Raoul, and we're to be working together.
Bridget frowned. The girl's response had not been rude, precisely. It had simply been so disconnected from the situation that etiquette utterly failed to apply.
May I know your name, please?
The girl sighed.
She wants to know my name, but I'm simply awful at introducing myself.
Perhaps I should tattoo Folly on my head, and then people can just read it.
Folly, Bridget said. It's a pleasure to meet you, Folly.
She seems very sweet,
Folly told the jar.
I'm sure she means well.
Raoul said,
This girl has too many things in her head, I think.
Folly replied,
Oh, the cat is right. All the things I've forgotten, plus all the things I haven't. I keep forgetting over which ones I need to throw a dust tarp.
Bridget blinked again. Before she left the Vattery, she could have counted on one hand the number of people she'd met who actually understood Cat. She glanced down to find Raoul staring into infinite distance, exhibiting no reaction.
Bridget knew the cat well enough to know that he had not been surprised.
Gwendolyn and Benedict caught up to them, finally, with Benedict staying close to a bemused Master Ferris's side.
"Simply saying," Benedict said, "that perhaps you could have gained the guard's cooperation without resorting to threatening to arrest him for impeding an inquisition."
Gwendolyn frowned. "Ought I have threatened to charge him with treason, do you think? That one bears the death penalty."
Benedict gave his cousin a rather hunted look.
"Gwen, you... I don't even... I can't possibly..." He shook his head, mouth open for a second. A very small smile touched Gwen's mouth, and her eyes sparkled.
Benedict sighed and shut his mouth again. "Touché. I'll stop telling you how to do your job now, cuz."
"Thank you,"
Gwen said.
Bridget smiled slightly at the exchange, and even Raoul seemed amused.
Not a minute later, a very tall young man, dark-haired and square-jawed, descended briskly from the ship and approached them, dressed in an aeronaut's leathers, his goggles hanging around his neck. He came to a stop before them, gave them a bow, and said,
"Ladies and gentlemen, I am Byron Creedy, Predator's executive officer. Master Ferris, Captain Grimm has asked me to bring you and your party aboard at your earliest convenience."
The old etherealist blinked and looked up from whatever private thoughts had preoccupied him. He looked the young man up and down, nodded, and said,
"Convenient would have been yesterday. Now will suffice."
Creedy arched a brow at this answer, but he bowed his head and said,
"Then if you would all please follow me, welcome aboard Predator."
Chapter 22 AMS Predator. Gwendolyn Lancaster looked around Predator with what she felt was well-earned skepticism. It seemed that in following the orders of the Spyrarch, she had fallen in with scoundrels. Though granted they had been fierce enough in battle, and granted that they had, in fact, quite possibly saved her life, probably, even. But after asking a few questions of passing crewmen, she had determined that the help of Captain Grimm and his men had gone first to the Lancaster Vattery. Possibly that had been coincidence at work, but Gwen's father put precious little store by such notions. The crystals her family's Vattery produced were quite literally the most valuable resource in the world, the most expensive piece of equipment one could purchase. It seemed a strange coincidence that the captain of a ship in dire need of replacement crystals should happen to wander by the Vattery. It seemed an equal stretch that he should then proceed to rescue the heir apparent of House Lancaster, purely by happenstance. She supposed that a military-minded man might have deduced that the Lancaster Battery would be a prime target of attack. But if Grimm had managed to piece all of that together in the chaos of the attack, he was the tactical equal of old Admiral Targwin himself, and Gwen hardly thought that the fleet would have cast out a captain of such ability. Of course, coincidences happened, and this could be one. But if it was not coincidence, then it meant that Captain Grimm had known enemy movements and intentions. It was possible that she was doing a courageous and capable man a grave disservice. But a determination to protect the Vattery was something that had been fed to her with her mother's milk and drilled into her during every hour of every day that had passed since. As theirs was the only crystal Vattery in the spire capable of producing core crystals, there simply was no alternative but to take every precaution possible. So while she felt a regret that perhaps Grimm deserved better of her, she faced her duty squarely and kept a quiet, calm eye upon the man. She mounted the steps to the airship's bridge, the conning tower at the forward end of the ship. The roof of the tower had a small raised platform at the rear, where the ship's steering grips were. The pilot would stand upon it, with the clearest view of anyone aboard of what was in front of the airship. The captain and his executive officer stood on the deck in front of the pilot, enjoying a similar view. Gwen supposed clear sight of the ship's surroundings would be quite vital in wartime. At the moment, the view was rather pedestrian. The mists had thickened as Predator cast off from her pier, and the ship currently hung in cloudy limbo. The sun, only a dim suggestion somewhere far above. The dull black walls of Spire Albion stretched out ahead and astern of the airship on its left, or port, side. A pair of heavy lines were fastened to a long tether cable that ran down the side of the spire, in order to prevent winds from causing the ship to drift away from the tower. A pair of long poles set out to the side of the ship kept winds from pushing it into the tower, too. They had already been underway for a quarter of an hour, and the black stern of the spire rolled slowly upward as the vessel sank down into the mist, heading for the shipyards of Havel Landing. The pilot, a rather hard-looking man whose name was Kettle, took note of her presence first, and cleared his throat loudly. Captain Grimm and Commander Creedy looked back at Kettle, and then at her. They glanced at one another, and then Creedy came over to her wearing a polite smile. "Miss Lancaster," he said, "how may I be of service to you?" Gwen straightened her dark blue uniform jacket and said, "I wished to ask you a few questions, sir, if that is quite all right."
"Certainly, miss."
Gwen nodded. "Are you the same Byron Creedy who lately served on the battle cruiser Glorious?" Creedy's friendly expression suddenly became very closed. "Indeed, miss. I had that honour." "Were you not habbled by the Fleet Review Board for conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman?" A muscle along the young man's jaw twitched, and Creedy gave her a brief, stiff nod.
"I see," Gwen said. "I may be required to place the success of our Inquisition and our very lives in your hands, Commander. I need to know what kind of man you are, and whether or not you will be there to help if I should call upon you."
"Thus far, miss," he replied in a very precise, polite voice indeed, "the captain and crew of Predator have been there to help you even when you have not called. Or so I judged the situation we found in the tunnel."
"Forgive me, sir," she said, "but we have little time, and I fear I must be direct and plain. You were cast in disgrace from the active service roles of the fleet. Your captain was exiled from the service entirely. Many of your crew members have similar service records with the fleet. It is quite the collection of men in disgrace."
"Perhaps, miss," Creedy said with a coolly lifted chin, "you would prefer to travel the remainder of the distance to landing without enduring the disgrace of our company."
"Byron,"
said Grimm, in a gentle, firm tone. Creedy glanced over his shoulder, let a breath out through his nose, and then turned back to Gwen to speak in a low, hard voice.
"Miss, if I were you, I would have a care what you had to say about the captain in front of any of his officers or crew, myself included. None of us particularly care to hear ill spoken of the man, and none of us will care who your parents are if you insult the captain. Do I make myself understood?" Gwen arched an eyebrow at him.
"Have I said anything that is untrue, Commander?"
"You have said nothing untrue," he replied. "You have also said nothing that is complete. There is more to the world than what a review board publishes about an officer or aeronaut, Miss Lancaster. Guard your tongue." And with that he gave her a rigid bow and strode off the bridge. His boots thumped solidly on the deck and the stairs as he left. When Gwen turned back to the front of the ship, she found Grimm standing 2 feet from her. The man had not made a sound to give away his approach, and Gwen had to force herself not to flinch as she found him facing her. He was, she thought, a rather striking man. He wasn't beautiful. His features weren't balanced. He had a rather heavy brow, which gave him a slightly brutish look, one that was belied by the glitter of intelligence in his dark eyes. His cheekbones were sharp and wide, and contrasted with his thick jawline. His mouth was narrow, though whether that was its natural form, or simply his current expression, Gwen couldn't say. He was of unimpressive height, but well-muscled, and he had the look of a man who could do heavy work for hours without tiring. His hands were blocky, square and strong, and he carried himself with the rigidly proper posture of the fleet, despite his disgrace. It was the blood on him, she thought, that made her uneasy. He had not yet changed out of the clothes he had worn in battle, not even the sling that cradled one of his arms.
"Captain Grimm," she said calmly.
"Miss Lancaster," he replied. "Why were you provoking my executive officer?"
"Because I've always found that people's reactions are more honest when they're tired, and I wanted to test his before he went to his bunk."
He seemed to consider this for a moment and then nodded.
"And you're speaking to me now for the same reason, I take it."
Gwen gave him a tight smile.
"Something like that."
The captain grunted.
"You're too young to be that ruthless."
"My nanny and several instructors told me the same thing," she said. "Your men still think well of you after the battle, Captain. That's remarkable."
"Do you think so?"
Gwen shrugged.
"There are many fleet captains whose men would sour on them if they suffered the casualties your crew did in battle."
"There are many fleet captains who are idiots," he replied.
"Your men do not seem to have been fazed."
"It was a fight that needed to happen," Grimm said. "They understand that. I didn't kill those men. The Aurorans did.
They understand that, too."
"All the same," Gwen said. "I asked around about you, Captain Grimm. I have some questions for you as well."
"I'm certain that you do, miss. Please proceed."
Gwen nodded.
"What can you tell me about the Perilous incident, Captain?"
Grimm's weary expression never flickered.
"I have nothing to say about it."
"That's what everyone seems to think," Gwen said, nodding. "The records of the Inquisition afterward have been sealed. Not even my father's influence could acquire them."
"It's done," Grimm said. "It's in the past, and best left there."
"Sir, the Admiralty seems to think," Gwen said. "A fleet captain dead in mid-cruise, his executive officer beaten into a coma, 3 young lieutenants left to bring a warship and her crew safely home through pirate skies, Lieutenants Grimm, Bayard, and Rook, to be precise."
Grimm regarded her impassively.
"To this day, no one is sure what happened on Perilous," she told him, "but she came home with heavy losses, and when the dust cleared, Lieutenants Rook and Bayard had been promoted to Lieutenant Commander, while Lieutenant Grimm was summarily drummed out of the service for cowardice in the face of the enemy.
His voice turned dry. I am somewhat familiar with the tale, miss.
It gives me serious concerns, Gwen said. Are you a coward, Captain?
The man stared at her with those shadowed eyes for several moments before he said, his voice very soft.
When needed, miss. When needed.
Gwen tilted her head.
I'm not sure what to make of that answer, Captain.
Good,
he said shortly. Mr. Kettle, if you would send for me a quarter of an hour before arrival.
Aye, Captain,
said the pilot in a laconic tone. Grimm gave her a short, brief bow. Miss Lancaster, he said. Then he turned and walked wearily down the steps to the deck. Gwen watched him cross to the center tower and enter his cabin. The man did not seem much like a scoundrel to her, nor did he seem to be a coward. She frowned thoughtfully until she felt the weight of the pilot's gaze on her. She looked up at Kettle and said,
"Do you believe what they said about him at the court-martial?"
Kettle grunted and peered ahead for a moment, and Gwen thought he had simply declined to answer. She had turned and begun to leave when he said,
"Miss Lancaster."
She paused.
"Yes?"
"I didn't know him when he was in the fleet, miss, but..."
Kettle took a slow breath, his lips moving slightly, as if composing his answer before he spoke. Then he nodded and turned his eyes to her, his expression intent.
"Miss Lancaster, Spirestone is heavy. Fire is hot, and the captain does his duty, no matter what it costs him. Understand?"
Gwen regarded Kettle's unshaven face for a slow breath and then nodded slowly.
"I believe I'm beginning to. Thank you, Mr. Kettle."
"There's nothing, miss."
"How long will it take us to reach landing?"
"Another hour of travel, and then we wait in line for a berth. Few hours, probably. We'll ring the ship's bell when we arrive."
"Thank you,"
Gwen said, and she turned to leave the pilot to his duties.
"Interesting."
Her father had always said that a man could be fairly judged by the quality of his allies and that of his enemies. Captain Grimm seemed to have a number of rather staunch allies, despite his disgraced status, apparently including Lord Albion himself. And despite what had happened to him, his pride was unbowed. If what Kettle said was true, then Grimm was a rather remarkable man, perhaps even the kind of man who could match tacticians of historic brilliance, the kind that made coincidences happen, rather than letting them happen to him. Perhaps he had saved her family's battery and her life because he had believed it his duty to do so. Or perhaps not. Time would tell.
Chapter 23 AMS Predator. Grimm's dreams were unpleasant, and concluded in a hectic racket that eventually resolved itself into the sound of someone knocking firmly at the door to his cabin. Before he'd had time to realize that he was actually awake once more, his legs had already swung out of his bunk, and he was sitting up by the time he muttered,
"In."
The door opened, and Stern leaned his head into the cabin.
"Begging your pardon, Captain."
Grimm waved a dismissive hand.
"We're there already, Mr. Stern."
"Still waiting for a berth,"
the wiry young man replied.
"But you've got a visitor from the fleet, sir."
Grimm gave the young man a sharp glance, and then a brisk nod.
"I'll be out momentarily."
"Aye, Captain,"
Stern said, and shut the door again.
Visitors from fleet. Now.
At least Grimm had been able to wash himself down at a basin of water before he slept. Now he rose, dressed himself as best he could in clean clothing, and awkwardly tied off a fresh sling for his wounded arm. He raked a comb through his mussed hair several times, scowled at himself in a small mirror, and eyed the stubble of a beard that marred any chance he might have of presenting himself in an officer's proper condition. Of course, he wasn't an officer of the fleet any more, was he? Grimm shook his head, tried to shake off the bone-deep exhaustion he still felt, failed to do so,
and went out of his cabin anyway.
"Captain on deck!" Stern barked as Grimm opened his door.
Grimm stepped onto the deck to see every crewman in sight stop whatever they were doing, turn toward him, and snap him a perfect fleet salute. He kept himself from smiling.
"Mr. Stern," Grimm said beneath his breath, "why is it that the crew bothers with formal protocol only when a serving member of fleet comes aboard?"
"Because we like to remind the uptight bastards that on this ship you're in command, Skipper, regardless of what fleet thinks of you."
"Ah," Grimm said.
He lifted his voice slightly.
"As you were."
The crew snapped out of the salute with near parade ground precision and returned to their duties. A dapper little figure in the uniform of a fleet commodore swaggered across a boarding plank laid out between Predator's deck and that of a fleet launch, hovering alongside Grimm's ship. The man hopped down onto the deck and shook his head in bright-eyed amusement.
"Permission to come aboard, Captain?"
"Bayard," Grimm said, stepping forward and offering the other man his hand.
"Mad," Bayard said, trading grips with him. "Good God in heaven, man. I knew Predator had been injured, but... were you talking to strangers again?"
"To Captain Castillo of Itasca, briefly," Grimm replied. "I took my leave before the conversation could go any farther than it did." "What are you doing here, Alex?"
"We heard that you'd been injured again while playing hero during the attack, and Abigail insisted that I look in on you."
Grimm gestured to his arm. "The rumor mill is performing to specifications, I'm afraid. I already had this when it started."
"I remember," Bayard said. "So, you repelled an assault by Auroran Marines with one hand?"
"My crew did the majority of that."
Bayard made a little ah sound. "Naturally. While you stood about offering critique, I suppose."
"It's as if you know me."
Bayard's teeth shone in a sudden smile.
"And you had no further injuries? From a critically pilloried crewman, perhaps?"
"A few scrapes and bruises. I'm well."
"That will ease Abigail's mind greatly," Bayard said. "Now, about that brandy."
"What brandy?"
"The excellent brandy you're about to pour me in your cabin, naturally," Bayard said in a cheerful tone, but his eyes were quite serious.
"I see," Grimm said, nodding. "I suppose if it gets rid of you more rapidly, it's a worthy investment." "This way, Commodore."
Bayard grinned. "And to think that they call merchant captains uncivilized." Once inside the cabin, Grimm shut the door behind them and turned to his old friend.
"All right. What's this really about?"
Bayard made a half-circle out of the fingers of his right hand and frowned down at them in puzzlement.
"That's odd. There's no drink there."
Grimm snorted. Then he went to the cabinet and came back with a couple of small glasses of brandy. He offered one to Bayard. Bayard took it, lifted it, and said, as he ever did when they drank together,
"Absent friends."
"Absent friends," Grimm echoed.
And the two of them drank.
"It's official,"
Bayard said after. "The Spire Council has declared a state of war with Spire Aurora." Grimm frowned.
"Inevitable, I suppose."
"Inevitable and ugly," Bayard said. "We're already sending out word to call in our ships, in First and Second Fleets alike. The Admiralty, in its wisdom, has decided to remain in a defensive posture until we have concentrated our entire fleet presence."
Grimm felt his eyebrows rising.
Aerial warfare was the very soul of sudden and overwhelming violence. A commander who surrendered the initiative to the enemy was a commander who might well be obliterated by a surprise offensive at the time and place of the enemy's choosing before he could ever give the order to engage.
"What?"
Bayard flopped down onto Grimm's narrow sofa.
"Exactly. This raid has rattled old Watson rather badly, I'm afraid.
Why?
Because the enemy set this attack up to manipulate him, and they succeeded. They jerked him around like a puppet on strings. If some poor fool hadn't been randomly wandering by the Lancaster Vattery...
Bayard lifted his glass to Grimm. Grimm rolled his eyes.
Watson's response might have cost Albion its most precious resource.
Bayard sloshed down a bit more brandy.
So he is proceeding with utmost caution in order to avoid falling into another such trap.
Unless, of course, Grimm said, they're trying to manipulate him into sticking one of his feet to the floor and piling up all our ships in one place.
Exactly.
Bayard sighed.
Every element of First Fleet is currently sailing in a giant circle around the spire to watch for trouble, like some kind of bloody carousel. Several of us tried to talk sense into him, but you know old Watson.
He's a rather brilliant defensive tactician,
Grimm said.
I agree, Bayard said. The problem is that he's an inept defensive strategist. We should be dispatching ships to hammer the Aurorans hard in their home skies, force them to think defensively, the damned fools encouraging them to take the initiative.
Grimm frowned down at his drink and said,
What does this have to do with me?
Bayard scowled. Don't give me that. Your fleet mad. Same as me.
The fleet rolls say otherwise.
There's a war upon us, his friend replied. This is no time for petty grievances. We need every skilled captain we can get.
I want you to come back.
I've been dishonorably discharged. I can't come back.
You're an experienced combat commander, Bayard countered. And you've won more than a little respect for your actions at the Lancaster Vattery. The Prime Minister of Albion himself watched you defend his home, his people, and his livelihood through his study window. If you come back to Fleet and offer your services, I think the winds are right to make it happen. And there happens to be a captain's slot I need to fill in my squadron.
Grimm looked up sharply.
Valiant,
Bayard said simply.
I need a flag, Captain.
Something lurched inside Grimm's chest, something that he'd forgotten over the past decade. The voice of a much younger, much less experienced Francis Madison Grimm, determined to win command of a fleet ship of his own. He wasn't sure whether it felt like fireworks exploding in his chest or the vertigo of a drunken tumble down a flight of stairs.
You're insane. I never commanded a fleet ship.
Yes,
Bayard said, his voice hardening.
You did.
Not officially, Grimm spat, not on paper. And no officer, no matter how popular or favored, is given a bloody heavy cruiser as his first command.
Rules are made to be broken,
Bayard replied. What they did to you wasn't right. I don't see how reversing that injustice could be wrong.
I'm working for the Spyrarch now,
Grimm said.
I know. But this is your chance, Mad, to make it all right. Come back to Fleet Command with me. Offer to rejoin.
Grimm narrowed his eyes.
You want me to go to them?
You want me to go to them with my hat in my hands and ask them to let me back in, pretty please, your lordships?
War, Mad,
Bayard said, leaning forward. This is bigger than me. It's bigger than Hamilton Rook and his family.
It's even bigger than your wounded pride.
We need you.
Then I look forward to being notified in writing of the clearing of my name and the restoration of my rank and standing in fleet, Grimm said.
Bayard's face became furious. Damn it, Mad. You have a responsibility, a duty.
You're right about that much, at least. But my duty to fleet ended years ago. I have other responsibilities now.
Bayard simply stared, anger radiating from his every pore. Grimm met his gaze without hostility and without yielding. After a moment, Bayard seemed to deflate. He made a disgusted sound and finished off the brandy in a gulp. "Damn your pride." Grimm finished his own glass and let the liquor burn down his throat, half afraid that the turmoil in his chest might set it alight.
"Alex, what you're asking me to do, I won't do it. I can't do it, I can't."
Silence fell. "Abigail said as much," Bayard said finally. "But I had to try."
"Thank you," Grimm said. "Truly."
Bayard moved one shoulder in a shrug, set his glass aside and rose. "I also wanted to give you some advance warning. Your XO is about to be put back on active duty. They're calling in everyone they've habbled and every reservist they can from the merchant fleet."
"I suppose that's hardly surprising," Grimm said, rising with him.
"How is he?" Bayard asked.
"He'll do," Grimm said in a firm tone. "When?"
"A week, at the longest," Bayard said.
"I'll make adjustments,"
Grimm said,
and the pair of them walked back out on deck together. "Please give Abigail my regards."
"You'll need to have a meal with us soon," Bayard said. Then he grimaced. "Wartime permitting."
"I should enjoy that."
"This arrangement you have with the Spyrarch," Bayard said, "will it last?"
"Perhaps. Perhaps not."
"Then I reserve the right to speak to you on the subject again."
"My answer shall not change."
"No, I don't suppose it shall." Bayard glanced up and then tilted his head a bit to one side. "Captain," he said, "what is that at the very top of your forward mast?" Grimm looked up, following Bayard's gaze, to where a small, solid form was outlined against the sunlit mist.
"Apparently," he said, "it is a cat."
Chapter 24. Spire Albion. Habel Landing. Raoul found the view from atop the foremost of the two ship trees to be less exciting than he had assumed it would be. Oh, he could see over the ship itself well enough, though based upon his understanding of the vessel's name, as if it needed one, he felt that its master should have been thanking cats for the obvious inspiration, at the very least. Perhaps there was an arrangement to be reached here. Certainly, if they named something after cats, even the dimmest of humans must understand that there was recompense to be discussed. The vessel itself had proved to be interesting. He had seen Little Mouse safely ensconced in a small room with a cup of hot drink, which tasted terrible, but which she insisted upon having frequently in any case. After that, he had gone exploring. There were many hallways and rooms upon Predator, as well as a number of things that needed chasing and catching. Probably not eating, though, unless he was truly hungry. Raoul felt sure that Bridget's fragile feelings would be crushed if he denied her the pleasure of sharing her meat with him. There was certainly a place for a cat on a construct such as this, provided he didn't mind the company. Once he had inspected the vessel, he had promptly climbed the ship tree, but the only things of interest to be seen from there were the humans moving about the ship, and honestly, it would be a long and dull day indeed before they proved more than momentarily interesting. A smaller ship, possibly also bearing a name inspired by his people, came alongside Predator. A human of significantly less clumsiness than most came aboard, a small male, and despite its diminutive stature, it moved with a warrior's confidence and wore a very large and fine hat. Such hats often signified humans who considered themselves important, which was adorable for the first few moments and trying ever after. The visitor had, however, entered the ship as if waiting to be permitted on another's territory, which was the proper way to do things. Raoul had begun to approve of the human, Grimm,
who had thus far acted with less than utter incompetence in every aspect of his life. If Grimm was able to command such respect even from humans with very large hats, he might make suitable help, and even humans were wise enough to realize that good help was the most elusive of quarries. Raoul followed the conversation Grimm had with the visitor. It seemed largely to be concerned with inexplicable human madness, though he understood the anger and raised voices that signified what might have been a bloodletting. As so often happened with the fickle beasts, it did not develop into a proper battle, and the visitor left in apparent defeat. Shortly after that, there was some activity between the tall second-in-command and a human operating several long levers with coloured cloth on the ends. They were apparently signals of some kind, because the humans peered down at something below them for a time after their flags waggled. What they saw seemed to satisfy them. The ship, which had been motionless, finally descended toward a wooden platform that, apart from minor details, looked almost precisely like the one they had just left. Raoul found that disappointing. It seemed a great deal of trouble for him to spend half a lifetime bored up a ship tree to gain very little in the way of an interesting change of environment. But such things were to be expected when dealing with humans. He would remain patient until they fumbled past such foolishness. Was he not, after all, a cat? He descended the ship tree. It was rather less enjoyable than the climb had been. It was an activity better suited to humans and their spidery fingers. He would have to see to it that there was a human prepared to climb up and carry him down with proper dignity next time. Perhaps it would be an opportunity to test the capability of human Benedict. Clearly, he was unworthy to be the mate of Little Mouse, but perhaps with the right guidance, some kind of adequacy could be nurtured. Raoul returned to the little room where Little Mouse and her companions were drinking their stinking water, and leapt up to grip the handle upon its door, hanging from it long enough to make it come open. Then he prowled in and shut the door again with a press of his shoulders. The human, Gwendolyn, blinked at him several times and then said, "When on earth did he leave? How did he leave?" Little Mouse nodded at him and said to human Gwendolyn, "He is a cat, Miss Lancaster. Asking such questions is an exercise in futility." Raoul leapt up onto Little Mouse's lap and nuzzled her cheek affectionately. He liked Little Mouse. She was far less stupid than most humans.
"The ship is landing," he told her. "We should go see what this new habble looks like at once."
He waited for Little Mouse to repeat what he had said to the other humans. Honestly, he sometimes felt that humans simply had to be deliberately obtuse. What was so difficult about understanding civilized and excellently enunciated speech? His father had often opined that, in fact, humans really were exactly as foolish and helpless as they seemed, or that life was simpler if one assumed it to be true at any rate. But Raoul was not yet sure. A moment later, an acutely unpleasant sound of metal striking metal sliced across the deck. It was one of those human noises that had been, he felt sure, created for no purpose whatsoever but to annoy cats. The sound did seem to galvanize the humans, though. Little Mouse and her companions rose and began fussing about, the way humans often did. The humans who operated the ship did the same, and after a pointless delay for the humans to collect all their toys and keepsakes, he was finally able to take his rightful place in Little Mouse's arms and herd them all in the proper direction. They descended from the ship onto a wooden platform that seemed to simply hang in open air from the side of the spire. He had to give humans credit where it was due. They did seem to have a knack for building interesting places for cats to explore. They walked over the creaking wooden planks, their steps echoing.
"Little Mouse," he said, "if the human platform fails, will we not fall to the surface?"
He could hear her heart speed up, and her hands become somewhat clammy against his fur.
"Nonsense! I'm certain it will do no such thing."
But she began to walk slightly faster. Little Mouse and her companions joined a rather large herd of humans who were